I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing the latest Pixar outing, Incredibles 2, as well as hearing from the film's producers, Nicole Grindel and John Walker. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me this week, the super stretchy elastic Steph Watts.
Hello.
Hello. The super speedy Campbell A. Campbell.
Hello.
Who dashed straight here from work.
On the tube, I guess.
And we're delighted to welcome a very special guest with us this week, joining us from the Cinemol podcast, Balancing Family Life with Fighting Crime on the Side, our own Mr. Incredible, Dave Corkery.
Oh, thanks very much. How's
welcome
it going?
Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
He's just flattering you.
Good to be here. I know, I got the Mr. Incredible role. What? Although he's the stay-at-home dad, that's his real
exactly.
superpower.
Yeah. I don't know who I'd get.
Jack.
Yeah.
Violet. I wish
you're invisible to us.
That's how I feel most of my life. If you would like to have your thoughts on Incredibles 2 read out on next week's show, then you can do so by emailing us podcast@curzon.com, or you can reach out to us via Twitter where we are at Curzon Cinemas. So before we hear from this week's guests, I just want to ask you guys about the first Incredibles film. So when did you first see The Incredibles, and what has it meant to you in the 14 years since it's released?
Well, I mean, I think I saw it when it came out in cinemas, but I can't really remember any film I saw in the cinema before 2005.
Right, okay.
But it's stuck with me for a really long time. It's kind of been the gold standard for animated films since then. And, you know, I just love the soundtrack. It's kind of just been a go-to.
Yeah.
What happened in 2005? Was that when you woke up not knowing who you were or how you got there?
I actually moved from South Africa, and the last film I watched was Revenge of the Sith, so I feel like that had something to do with
that traumatic event.
There was no cinema before Revenge of the Sith.
As far as I'm concerned. No, that makes it sound like it's the only thing that matters.
Cinema.
I'm really sad that I don't remember seeing this in the cinema, because it's genuinely one of my favourite films of all time. It's a big kind of family film for my family, because obviously, like, my parents remember taking me to see it. And yeah, I kind of watch it a lot. So yeah, it's like a really big part of my life, I guess.
Okay.
I saw it once in the cinema in 2004, and I never watched it again.
So glad you're here.
It's not been a big part of my life, but I liked it. Yeah. I really did like it. It's one of the Pixar films that I just never rewatched for whatever reason.
I think it might be my favorite Pixar film.
I feel like I'm the black sheep of the podcast.
It's funny because the only Pixar film I've never rewatched is Ratatouille, so maybe there's something about Brad Bird.
I never rewatched that one either.
I don't know. Both are great, but I just never saw it again.
Yeah.
I saw it at my friend's bowling party. We went bowling and then watched The Incredibles for his birthday. I remember it really vividly. Yeah, I still love it. I'm like you, Steph. I think I watch it like very, very frequently. At
religiously.
Least once a year. Religiously, yeah. So it's been quite a long time. So it's 14 years ago now. And when they announced they were doing a sequel, what were your initial thoughts about the idea of an incredible sequel? Was it met with optimism or skepticism?
It was a hell yeah from me.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think the fact that they've waited so long. And I think Brad Bird had said he didn't want to do one until he kind of felt ready to do another one, kind of, yeah, had good faith in it. Yeah, but then again, I found it absolutely impossible to actually keep my expectations in check, just because I was so excited about it happening.
I'm going to be the dissenting voice again. I didn't care about this at all. I watched the trailers. I wasn't interested or excited. I felt nothing. I've been burned. I felt hollow and dead inside.
I feel nothing.
I've been a little burned by the Pixar sequels in general, besides the Toy Stories.
You didn't like Cars 2?
I wasn't really expecting much.
Okay. Yeah, I had mixed feelings about the sequel, but I think the fact that you've got Brad Bird back is a huge deal. And we'll get into the film in a bit. But before that, it's time for this week's interview. So Nicole Grindle has been working in animation and with Pixar for many years now, fully graduating to a producer here, while John Walker has been at Brad Bird's side for most of his feature films. And I spoke to both of them a few weeks ago.
And we're delighted to welcome to the Curzon podcast Nicole Grindle and John Walker, producers of The Incredibles 2.
Wow, it's nice to be here.
Very well, thank you. Thanks for being here. So it's been 14 years since the first film, and in those 14 years, superhero films have become almost, you know, kind of the default for the American blockbuster these days.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah. How did this affect your approaches to this film?
Well, it was a bit daunting at first, but Brad actually said that it cooled his jets a little bit to work on this film initially. But then when he looked at it, he recognized it's essentially a film about a family.
Right.
And that's what distinguishes it from the rest.
Right. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, we had a big fight with Michael Giacchino at one point, who's a composer of the film. He goes, "You can't go back to that. You can't. There's too many superheroes. Yeah. We got to do something new." And we went, but if we don't do it, somebody else will do it. And it's really about a family." He goes, "All right." You know, so we did it. But he's come around since then. And
now he kind of loves it.
He did a great score for it, too. Yeah. So it's
he did.
And did it take much convincing for the people at Pixar to get this film?
They've been great. I mean, they were like, "When you're ready, we're ready." So there wasn't too much convincing. No. I mean, once we got started, we had to convince them it was going to be good.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's always that. Yeah. But the idea in general of an Incredibles film they were open to. Pixar's great about waiting until filmmakers really have a story they want to tell. It's a great business model to make sure that your storytellers are inspired and have the time they need to develop it. And it turns out this has been worth the wait. It's worked out, and I think it's because Brad was ready to write the story now.
And you get this sort of weird collateral audience development feature that nobody really thought about, but it's, you know, if you wait that long, kids that saw it at 10 are now in their 20s. Some of them have their own kids at this point, and you have this multi-generational audience that is like, "Oh, well, that's kind of cool."
And there's a similar thing with Toy Story as well, right? So when I saw first Toy Story, I was Andy's age, I guess, in the first one. And when I saw the third one, I was his age for the third one.
Oh, yeah. That totally worked out. Yeah, we didn't plan it that way.
Yeah, it's like, it's all sort of serendipitous, but it's, you know, we go back to this, when the story's ready and the filmmakers are ready, that's when you do it. And you get these odd sort of serendipitous happy accidents about, you know, that come up.
Well, and it's true too that the stories we're telling reflect what's happening in the filmmakers' lives.
Right.
You know, we had kids that were Andy's age,
so
we were ready to tell the story of him going off to college when our kids were ready to go off to college. I mean, that exactly mirrored my experience.
Perfect.
It was very emotional for me making that film because I was living it at home.
Okay, but what's interesting about Incredibles 2 then is that I saw Incredibles when it came out 14 years ago. But now that I'm watching it, it's not as if Dash and Violet have grown up, because this film takes place seconds after the first one.
That's right.
Obviously, this was from Brad, but can you talk about why that decision was made, not to have the film make a big time jump and see what's happening to the family in real time? Can you talk about why you think you've chosen to go immediately after?
I mean, the one reason is it's a bold choice.
Sure.
You know, and that's interesting. The other is that the superpowers are tied to who the people are in the family and where they are in the family. So that, you know, the father is strong, so Bob has, you know, super strength. Moms are pulled in, you know, many directions, so she stretches. Violet is a teenager with, you know, a little, you know, who wants nothing more than to disappear and put force fields between her and everybody else. And Dash is a 10-year-old Ritalin kid. And, you know, babies are nothing but potential. And if you age them up, suddenly those powers don't fit right anymore. You know, it's like the powers are pegged to how old they are and their position in the family. So that those two reasons.
It's sort of like The Simpsons, you know. If you grew Bart up, it just wouldn't be the same, work. Right?
And you can do it in animation, right?
Exactly.
We had to replace Dash because he's 25 or 4 now. Mm-hmm. But everybody else, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, they sound the same, and you don't need to do it. And you can't do that in live action. So
there we go.
Action.
So we're seeing the film a year earlier than its initial announcement. Was that a sign of confidence for you guys, or was it a bit of a, did it create this kind of chaotic atmosphere, like, oh my God, we're losing a year? What was
both?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, they came to us because Toy Story 4 needed a bit more time to develop their story and asked us if we'd be willing to move up.
Yeah.
And, you know, truthfully, we didn't have a lot more story, it felt to us, than Toy Story 4, but we decided that, you know, they had confidence in us and we would go for it. It was hard. It was a really tough, just under 3-year sprint to this point.
Yeah.
That's fast for Pixar, so.
Yeah. Okay. So, John, you've worked with Brad on, was it all of his...
I didn't do Ratatouille,
but
Nicole did.
I was on Ratatouille with him.
And I didn't work on Ghost Protocol, but I worked on all the others.
The majority. Okay. Yeah. So can you talk about what it's like witnessing his sort of creative process?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm a big fan. I started working on Iron Giant with him, and I just went on a job interview and started work. I was the associate producer on that film. And within the first couple of weeks of working with him, and my job on that film was sort of just following Brad around and arguing with him, because we made that movie in 2 years, and it was, you know, not under the best of conditions at Warner Brothers, and so it was vital that we make it on time and on budget, and so we would just argue all the time, and it became clear within really a couple of weeks that he was, you know, a fantastically gifted director, and that I had seen a lot of directors over the years, and I was, you know, and frankly, a lot of them had been hacks, and it was like, wow, this guy's going to make some great films, and he has. You know.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree, and I feel that working with Brad, you learn so much about filmmaking. Mm. He has this enormous body of knowledge that he carries around about filmmaking in general, animation as well, and he shares that with the crew. He explains very carefully in every single meeting with the crew why he's making certain choices, and he makes references to all these different films that he's seen, and it's an education and it's inspiring, and I agree, he's just an enormous talent. I don't get where the ideas come from. They just seem to drop out of the sky.
It's like it appears that all is lost, you know, and suddenly he comes in and goes, oh, I got this idea, and you go, oh man, that's freaking great, you know? Where did that come from?
You know, I still remember he came into Ratatouille a little bit late, and so there were certain characters that had already been created, and Gusteau existed as a chef in that movie, and he came in one day and he said, all right, I know this is going to sound weird, but I've decided to use Gusteau differently. He's going to be like this little fairy that floats around. And trust me, it's going to be cool. And it was the weirdest thing to suggest. And of course, it worked tremendously well.
Yeah.
But yeah, you had to kind of like stick with
go
him.
With it.
Just trust him, and it's going to be great.
Yeah.
So he killed Gusteau.
He
killed Gusteau.
Yeah, with his bare hands.
Yeah.
And we always joked about it. I said, you know, if you'd had more time to make that movie, you never would have killed off Gusteau. You never would have had, you know, you were desperate, buddy.
Yeah. And it was a brilliant move.
Yeah, right.
So Obviously, it's not all about the money, but we are recording this the first Monday after its opening weekend, and you have broken the record for the biggest animated opening weekend.
Mm-hmm. We have.
Yeah, yes.
It's amazing.
It must be a pretty big relief for you guys, I guess, and you're pretty happy about that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as I said, we were relieved just to finish making the movie.
Sure.
Because it was so hard, but to have it so well-received is amazingly gratifying. We just love watching people watch the movie and enjoy it.
Yeah, and it means for us, it's great. But yeah. what really makes us happy is that it usually means we can do it again.
Yeah.
that it's like yes. if you don't perform well at the box office, you may not get another chance, yes. no matter how many films you've done before.
So our license has been renewed.
Yeah, it's like we're all right, one more.
Yeah, you got away with this one.
All right, we'll let him do one more.
And so I guess Pixar's kind of known for making films that are, they're very open to appealing to both children and adults. And I remember in the first Incredibles film, there's an attempted suicide very early on. And
just, you're right.
There's these big themes.
When you say it that way.
I know. But I just wanted to ask about how...
And a bit of we allude to Bob having an affair.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Someone gets shot in the beginning of this movie.
Those are things that I guess a lot of kids will have to ask their parents about later. But I wanted to ask about what's the process of making sure the balance is kept right, in that, but also not that it gets too, I guess, too silly or too childish, so that it appeals to both of those.
We make films for ourselves, I guess we're just big kids, We make something that we enjoy, and we don't want to exclude children, and we certainly don't want to terrify them. I think those illusions are fairly subtle.
Yeah, scare them a little bit, though. We want them to, we want to get them a little scared,
But I believe kids can take it, I think that many filmmakers underestimate kids, and they live in this world with us, and they know that the world is a hard place, and I think fairy tales can be incredibly intense and harsh. So,
yeah.
I dispute the idea that those ideas are off limits for kids.
Well, and I think kids love to learn about, and it's okay if they don't understand everything.
Yeah.
I remember my dad had a Charles Addams cartoon book, and when I was a kid, I loved the drawings, but I didn't understand any of it. And as I got older, I was able to, that's why that's funny. That's why that's funny, as I learned more and more and more.
Yeah.
And I think, you want that. You want, I crave that. I was like, I want to figure this out. Why is that funny?
Yeah.
There's stuff in Looney Tunes as well.
Yeah,
there's a lot
of
stuff. Those were made for adults.
Absolutely, yeah. So you've both worked in animation for a while now. And I wanted to ask, how has the perception of animation changed since you started? How is it treated? Is it more respected, and in what ways?
Well, like I said, I Looney Tunes, the classic animation was made for adults. And I think the stuff that I watched when I was a kid was made for adults. And then over time, I think it became ghettoized a little bit. When I first started in my career, we were always trying to make edgy stuff for adults. Mm. I mean, I worked making stuff for MTV, a show called Liquid Television, that was, skewed completely to adults. I don't think it was really that interesting for kids. And I think Pixar's been able to kind of land it back into this place where it's for all audiences.
Sure, yeah.
So that's
Certainly something that we have been working on for a long time. It's like it is not for children. It is for everybody.
Right.
That's a steady drumbeat that we have been hitting for 20 years, and it feels like, especially, the thing that's most gratifying about this last weekend is that we have a huge percentage of the audience that are adults,
mm-hmm.
Much more than anybody realized.
I think it's about two-thirds.
Two-thirds. And that's like, right, that's what on the first film, we had really wanted to push it to college kids,
and the
marketing people are kind of like, all right, but they did it, and they put us on a tour, and we went to different colleges and pushed it, and we tried, and you move the needle a little bit every time, and I think that it's this one. I think really has it's we can see sort of the fruits of that labor, yeah.
I mean, come on, television. There's a bunch of television animation that's for adults,
yeah,
as well. So I'd like to just dispense with that idea altogether. It's just for kids.
Right, great. Congratulations on the film and on the opening weekend. And it's been a pleasure, Nicole Brindle and John Walker.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, so let's dive straight into the film then. Incredibles 2, written and directed by Brad Bird. 14-year gap between the two films, and yet this film takes place immediately after the first one. I think a lot of people would have expected from Incredibles 2, you're going to get like adult Dash and Violet, and it's going to see how they've aged as well. But this film, I think, makes a really smart decision to take place like seconds after the first one.
I thought that was really interesting because with a lot of legacy sequels, like you said, they've kind of been aging up everyone. So especially with films that Disney's been doing as well. So like with Star Wars, Force Awakens, and focusing on legacy characters and what happened to your favorite heroes who are now withered and weary. but I thought it was a really interesting decision because, you know, there was the whole build-up where Brad Bird was saying, I won't do it again unless I've got, like, something that, like, comes to me. And then, like, I'm surprised that that kind of eureka moment was, he's like, you know what, I'll just continue it straight on from the last one. And I just thought that was a really peculiar choice, which I think turned out for the best.
Yeah.
Because it kind of just acts as, like, a mirror to the first film in a good way.
Yeah, and I think you don't, by picking up where it left off, you don't have to kind of fill in all these gaps. What have you left behind between the first one and the second one? What kind of new dynamics do we have to understand? It's just kind of bam, straight back into it. Yeah. Is it Toy Story 3? Andy's like grown up as well.
Yeah, Andy goes to college.
And I feel like with a lot of the Pixar films, you get a lot of this kind of like, my children are growing up and they're leaving me type thing. And I was a little bit worried that that would be kind of what was going to happen with Incredibles, obviously like a big part of its family, but I'm glad that it kind of stuck to the same time and didn't try and kind of like tug on your heartstrings with that kind of narrative.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree, Steph. I think it allowed him some freedom because he doesn't have to go in and dump a lot of exposition as to what everybody's been doing for 14 years. So it definitely afforded a bit of freedom there, I think.
Yeah, and as well, I think looking at it in the sort of larger scale of Brad Bird's career. So this is his return to animation, not just his return to The Incredibles, but his return to animation. He started off as an animation director. He did, he worked on The Simpsons, did The Iron Giant. He worked with Disney in his earlier career. And then he did The Incredibles and Ratatouille. And then he did Mission Impossible 4, which I absolutely love.
Woo!
Yeah.
I watched that last night.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well, the football was on.
Let's not talk about the football.
It didn't come home, guys.
It didn't come home. It's staying away. It's sleeping on the sofa.
It's moved out for good. It's grown up and left home.
And then he did Tomorrowland, which was a bit of a disaster for Disney. Have you guys seen Tomorrowland?
No, still.
Yes.
Nope.
What are your thoughts on Tomorrowland?
It's 2/3 of a great movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a failure, but it's an admirable failure.
I think it's really interesting that it's one of the few films where Brad Bird has mostly ceded control of the narrative to Damon Lindelof, who in all cases is a good writer, but he just doesn't tie together.
No.
Like it's the mystery box thing kind of blown wide open and just never really comes back together. But on the way there, it's really kind of thrilling because, I mean, it's Brad Bird. He knows how to put an action scene together.
And he also turned down the chance to direct Star Wars Force Awakens to do Tomorrowland.
Well, I mean, of course you would.
Of course you do, obviously.
That but could only have gone to a Mission Impossible director.
Yeah, that was the policy.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine John Woo's Star Wars. Oh, Brian De Palma's
yes,
Star
please.
Wars.
Do not. Oh, that'd be great, Brian De Palma's Star Wars.
Like the split screens.
Yeah.
Split diopters.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be weird. So I guess this is kind of a little bit, I don't think this is necessarily seen as him returning with sort of his tail between his legs. Like, okay, I'll go back to animation if my live action film career isn't picking up. But I think this is a triumphant return for him.
It's great seeing him kind of flex with the new technology and budget that's available to him, because this film looks amazing.
Yeah.
It's just kind of popping with these colours that the first Incredibles didn't have. Like, so on a base level, it already looks really amazing, but then he just goes the extra mile with all of the kind of powers that they put on display, and everything just kind of moves perfectly. It's just really finely tuned.
Yeah, this film takes so much time. Well, not so much time, it takes a bit of time to actually like kind of flex its like animation muscles as well. There's that whole sequence when they move into their new house and it's just Dash playing around with all the features, and like that's just pure we can do this because animation has got better, basically.
And they could do water so well,
so
now
good.
I thought they did water pretty well in the first one.
They did, to be fair.
The plane scene is like a standout.
Whole bit I think is amazing. Actually, I was thinking about this, like the Incredibles film, I feel like was it one of the first like films where it was all humans in Pixar?
It's definitely the first Pixar film to have all humans.
Yeah. Because I feel like that's, I mean, for it to be that early, like you have to make them look like people. You can't kind of just be like, oh, it's a fish or a monster and it can move however.
Or a car.
Or a car, yeah.
I remember a way that they got around that was that they had a kind of technology that would like randomly generate figures for...
And they just duplicate them, right?
Yeah, so they focused all their energy on like the kind of main cast, which is actually not too big.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of filled the background out with...
Yeah,
these, well, extras, I guess.
You can really see the difference in the texture of the backgrounds in particular, and the detail between these two movies. I think the animation has really moved along. You can see the difference there. Because obviously they couldn't, well, they didn't really do too much with the characters themselves, because they had to, you know, moments had passed, so they had to kind of look the same. So I think that was very interesting. But it and particularly the action sequences in this movie, just the ambition and the scope of them. I mean, I think we'll probably talk about the flexi bike.
Oh.
Is that what it's called?
It's so.
Elasticycle.
Elasticycle.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Petition starts now for flexi bike.
Yeah. That sounds like a kind of fitness class.
It does, actually. Yeah.
I mean, both do.
I got it. But,
God.
Yeah, there were definitely moments where I actually kind of gasped at how good it looked.
Yeah.
There was a bit with Bob's wearing like a polo shirt and it has like lint on it, and like it just looks
so
amazing.
Good.
Yeah, compared to like Incredibles 1, where they have the like shiny suits that have no texture.
Yeah, we were talking about this before, weren't we? Yeah.
Yeah, because you were saying you didn't really like, you weren't keen on like the red suits.
I've never liked the red suits. I always thought the old ones are better. But then I've come around. This film is like, I'm a believer now. Like, because like you were saying, everything has so much texture and detail that even these things like feel like tangible, as opposed to, you know, just like bits of rubber. But you know, it's like what the technology could afford at the time.
Definitely.
We can animate lint now. We're living in a golden age.
The kids are gonna love it
now.
Look, Mom, lint. Do you think was there one guy at Pixar who was like, all right, you're gonna do the lint you're
guy.
On the lint job, I'm afraid. And then Brad just kept coming around, the lint is wrong, this is not lint. Do it again.
And then he's like, well, it's not the lint Credibles.
Hey.
Wow. Oh. Weak.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry. I'm warming up.
Yeah, okay, we'll get there. I also love this film. They seem to double down on the 60s setting. Because, I don't know if it's just me, but I always forget that the first film was set in the 60s.
It was kind of ambiguous. It was ambiguous. Kind of in the way that like something like It Follows was, whereas...
It looks like the 80s, but there's also a cell phone, so it's a bit...
It's like retro-futurism, but with a blended, like just enough to keep you guessing, but this is absolutely... set in the 60s, because I think I'm pretty sure Mr. Incredible's watching like The Outer Limits or something.
Yes.
Like,
bang on.
Yeah.
And they've got the furniture, the like the low riding furniture.
Oh, yeah.
But I love with this about like being kind of set in the 60s that it's not kind of like dystopian cities. It's utopian city where they've got like the monorail, and that's kind of what people were like dreaming about at that time.
Retrofuturism.
But yeah.
And that's kind of what I think Brad Bird's really into, that, because that's a little bit what Tomorrowland's kind of about. about how, like, in the 50s and 60s, people had this idea of what the future would look like. And obviously, that's what the sort of the subject matter of Tomorrowland, and whether it successfully conveys that is another question.
We, the maniacs, burned it up.
Yeah. but here he seems to just fully go for it and be like, I want this to be my, this is what my universe is going to be like how a real Disney idealized vision of like utopia, like you say.
It's like the anti-Watchmen.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the first one was anyway. I mean, this deals with pretty much the same themes as in, should we really like hand responsibility and our like our safety and put it in the hands of these like individuals who may or may not be nuts? And I think it runs with it in a really compelling way, unlike, you know, Snyder's whole thing.
Yeah, definitely.
I will say though, you mentioned there that it sort of mirrors the themes of the first one. For me, it actually mirrored it a little too closely. I think a lot of this felt like retread material for me, in that it's essentially the same plot that Mr. Incredible has in the first one. They've just sort of swapped genders. The only difference is that it's not a secret this time. We've got eccentric billionaires recruiting them to do work. I mean, they do double down on the idea which you just stated of should we reinstate superheroes? But for me, it was a little too close to the original. I would have rather they completely opened the box and did something brand new.
Maybe.
Do you think that's partly because in the 14 years between the first one and this one, we've had like the superhero boom, and that we're so used to seeing, because that, I mean, the main theme of most superhero films, I suppose, especially, I don't know, is like,
should, civil war, isn't it?
Yeah, like, should we have heroes or should they leave everything to the authority? That's kind of like a theme that most superhero films have. So do you think maybe that's...
Yeah, legislation's really hot right now. Yeah. Everyone like, if your movie doesn't have superhero legislation, forget about it.
And the Star Wars prequels knew the hot button topic before even we
taxation.
Did.
Taxation. Get those
kids
trade
want
routes.
Taxes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know about it mirroring the first one too closely, because I think it twists enough on the parenting angle that it feels fresh. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the other one is like this kind of... I mean, there's his longing for the past in this one as well, but it's a bit of a lower key than before. The first Incredibles is more about settling into a groove, like kind of regretting letting go of your past and all of that. And then this one has this focus on finding the joy in parenting, I think. He's just kind of lost without his work, and he's just, because pretty much that was his sole direction. So now that he's kind of left at home, he's rudderless. But then a lot of the films, like, I think the film's most powerful arc is just in him spending time with his children.
Yeah.
I loved all that stuff. And I'm a new father myself. We have a 10-month-old. And I was just, and we brought our son to this. It was a family screening. We did check with the cinema. They were happy with that. So I was sitting there with my son on my lap trying to sort of juggle him as he was trying to escape. And it was like Mr. Incredible was doing the same thing. So it was like this brilliant 4D experience. But I really identified with so much of what he went through. And I think most parents will. And that's the beauty of what Pixar do best, is finding those little relatable moments that humanize these characters. So I thought all that stuff was just beautifully done.
You two are at the same screening, right?
I think we must have been.
Like, the one with all the kids and babies
screening.
And the
with
dress.
The arts and crafts.
Yeah,
yeah. We missed all of it because my son had a toilet emergency.
Oh, nice.
So did I at my screening. There was a press screening as well, so it didn't go down too well. But you were saying to me earlier about how fun it was to watch the film in that environment.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think it was good because as much as like I love the Pixar films and enjoy them as an adult, I think they are still kind of their family films and their kids' films, and it was really fun to see it in that environment where you can actually see the audience it's partly intended for actually watching and reacting to it.
I also enjoyed the irony of seeing a couple of kids on their phones for the entire film when the villain is called Screen Slaver.
Okay, should we talk about the villain then a little bit? So obviously the first film has Syndrome, who I think is a really great villain, voiced by Jason Lee. This film has Screenslaver, who is a bit more of a mysterious figure, shall we say?
Yeah.
I think in that he's maybe a bit more kind of ambiguous.
Yeah.
I don't think it can really top Syndrome and the way that his kind of arc fits in with the story of the first Incredibles film. But I think like it's still good and it's still kind of our time.
Mm-hmm. Looks cool as well.
It does look very cool. There's the bit when Elastigirl is fighting him cage match. In like cage the cage match, match. Oh, sort of, like strobe. Yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, by the way, if you have epilepsy,
fair warning. Yeah,
yeah.
That scene is amazing though. It's really like throughout this whole film, Bird is really amazing at just creating these instant like tangible stakes. You're instantly invested in this moment, and it's probably one of the more perilous and terrifying fight scenes ever, because the screen slaver character's got this like basically a cattle prod, which is numbing Elastigirl's arms, and she kind of, she's just kind of losing control of her body, and it just becomes more and more tense as it goes on. And like, it's just one example of all of these action scenes which just are really immaculately constructed, and you feel so much like during those. Sorry, like I completely went away from my main point, because I wanted to say something about Syndrome compared to Screenslaver, and that like I think Syndrome might have been a better kind of synthesis of Ideal and someone that we kind of connect to emotionally, because we've got his origin story that plays out at the beginning. So it's just the kind of story of the entitled
buddy.
Yeah, buddy, the entitled fanboy who goes insane when he realizes that something is not within his control, much like fans of some franchises today. But yeah, then we have this kind of connection to the character already. We absolutely know where they're coming from. But with this, motivations are introduced a little late in the game.
Yeah.
And then the character becomes more of a vehicle for this opposing idea to what the Incredibles believe. It's a really interesting one because it kind of, I thought it spoke to, it's kind of spoke as this voice that has been going against Brad Bird and saying like, oh, he's an objectivist and like all of this. And it's kind of the Screenslaver acts as kind of a mouthpiece for that kind of idea, which the film then refutes in a really good way. But I get the kind of emotional connection to that character comes a little bit too late for me. But I think it's something that I am going to appreciate on my inevitable second and third and whatever 100th viewing.
We're going to do no spoilers here, but I think there is a mystery around Screenslaver that I perhaps could have done without. I think it's a bit, it's very pointed to very early on, I think.
If you've seen movies, you'll probably figure it out.
If you've seen a motion picture.
What's a movie?
Talkie.
How did you get in here?
What's a talkie? I thought they were just a fad.
They'll never last.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a bit unnecessary just with, I think what works so well in both of The Incredibles is the kind of superhero kind of being drawn in like by their own ego a little bit, which kind of works in both of these films, and maybe the second one didn't need that kind of extra bit.
Yeah. But yeah, they need a reason to get back into action, I suppose. And the character that's pushed to the focus of this film is, I think, very much Elastigirl, Helen Parr, voiced by Holly Hunter, who has the most incredible voice ever. And what do you guys think of her? What do you think of her arc in the film? The fact that she's brought forward, whereas the last one she was slightly secondary.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it,
I think this film kind of just showed off that she's got the coolest power. Stretching powers are cool.
It's very cool.
The way that Bird shows off her powers in just this stacking like number of ways that each one is kind of different from the last. Like, we'll have a moment where she'll slingshot herself from a building and then kind of turn into a glider.
So good.
Just these really,
it's a flying squirrel.
It's so creative the whole way through, and every action sequence with her just kind of feels like it feels like there's endless possibilities to what the film could do. And then the fact that it's an animated film also compounds that, because the camera follows her in these really impossible ways as well. So like I was saying, when she launches herself through the air, the camera just sticks to her in a way that would probably be just kind of impossible, or at least break you out of the immersion in another film that's live action, because it's all seamless and it's all an animated film. We are in a separate reality and not grounded in the real world.
That's why this is the best Fantastic Four movie we'll ever get.
Yeah.
I've been saying this for ages.
Yeah, I think you can tell Brad Bird's been away from animation, because he's thinking, what couldn't I have done in the past two films that I can do now? And it's all to do with Elastigirl. Because there's hints of it in the first one where she turns into a parachute and she's a speedboat. And you think, more of that, please. And this one's like, okay, you wanted more of that? Here's the bike chase. The Elastibike, Elasticycle.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Flexi ride.
cycle
stretch.
Two classes for £20.
Yeah, I think that's really where the film like really kicked into gear for me a little bit. I think just because, well, this is the point where Elastigirl gets to actually enjoy like using her powers. She doesn't really get to enjoy it. She just cleans up in the first one. And then this one, you really get the like, you get all of her like really stretching. You get the amazing soundtrack, like just really jazzing it up in that scene. And I feel like you really feel it kind of really moving along and like get a lot of joy out of it.
I'm a big fan of the act two, also known as How Elastigirl Got Her Groove Back. Like the kind of thing about the Elasticycle is twofold. It's like, one, she used to have a motorbike which is cool enough on its own, and then when you find out it breaks in half to accommodate her stretchy powers, and she just kind of gets to use them while she's riding the cycle to like launch herself onto bridges or buildings or like ride on two different surfaces at the same time. It's just unbelievable.
It's great. It just kind of stomps all over. Do you know in the first one where kind of Mr. Incredible is going off in his car and he's like, bye honey, and then she rides off on her bike through a waterfall.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the bike chase is, I think it's the best action set piece of the year.
Mission Impossible is like 2 weeks away.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I'm gonna hold my tongue.
Okay.
But it's up there.
Yeah.
But she didn't injure herself in any of the stunts.
Yeah, that's why that kind of docks a point for me. I want to see actors in near-death situations.
I want to see bones breaking.
Bones breaking, rich people nearly killing themselves for my entertainment.
The other highlight for me, and this is one that loads of people have been talking about, and it's something Brad Bird wanted to do for the first film but couldn't fit it in, which is Jack-Jack versus the Raccoon. We haven't mentioned Jack-Jack yet.
But,
so in the first film, it's introduced that he can do anything and everything a little bit, and I forgot that they don't know that. Mm-hmm. That's carried on to this film, that none of the family know what his powers are, and this film has a lot of fun with what Jack-Jack can do, and there's a particular scene where he has a pretty brutal fight with a raccoon.
This is just Pixar at its best, isn't it? It just felt like a short movie, and it's
which,
because they did that other short with Jack-Jack
Attack.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, with the babysitter.
That's right.
I love that bit.
It felt like a little bit like a little bonus treat that Brad Bird gave us. So good, but like just like the way he crafted it with him watching this this old fashioned TV show with the burglar mask and then the raccoon. That's just so perfect, and it's so. Was funny, but it's also ridiculously well choreographed.
Yeah.
Like as a fight scene, it's very, very good. I loved it. My favorite thing of all Jack-Jack stuff in the movie, though, is when Frozone comes over to the house and Mr. Incredible is exhausted and, you know, he first disappears into the other dimension. And I have listened to the clip of tired Craig T. Nelson saying the word cookie in various different ways over and over and over again. And I'm telling you, it does not get old.
It's perfect. I love that with the whole, it could have gone really hard on the whole Mr. Mom route him, but I love that it's not that he's just like, oh, I don't know how to take care of my kids because I'm a working man, but it's more just like taking care of kids is exhausting. He's so tired. And the bit with Jack-Jack is just this cherry on top, which is a perfect bit of physical comedy, which actually kind of reminded me of The Iron Giant, which Steph and I watched the other day, like with you know, with the bit on TV where Hogarth is watching that fake sci-fi movie, and then it's kind of choreographed to what he does next when he hears a noise in the attic. But it's just, it's basically like, I don't know, just a juiced up version of that.
Has your 10-month-old exhibited any of the powers of Jack-Jack yet, though?
He has the powers to defecate on whenever he likes. And the power to
very useful
to be in danger at all times.
Wow.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I also love Jack-Jack and Edna Mode when he's the lollipop that is like her cigarette. That's so good. That's really great. I think bringing back Edna Mode is a little bit indulgent. I mean, everyone loves that character. She's not necessary for the film. I think it's a little bit like, oh, people liked her, we'll throw her in. I still got a kick out of her.
It was definitely like a good bit of fan service.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like I would have been disappointed if she wasn't in it. So
I
feel like it's definitely like we have to have her in there, even if it's just for a short scene. Yeah, and I think it worked really well because, it added the kind of her meeting Jack-Jack and kind of
It softened her a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's the film shows so much restraint in that kind of area anyway that it didn't really reflect on me. And also we have the it's worth it for Jack mirroring Edna as well. speaking of his powers as well, I really like the metaphor of Jack having this like library of powers as like a whole. Oh yeah, like babies have like all this potential and like, yeah, you don't know what they'll be yet. Well, just a nice addition to all of the other characters whose powers are basically an extension of their personalities.
Yeah. I hope his solo power is becoming giant, because that absolutely killed me.
Terrifying. Really terrifying. And what did you guys make? So we haven't spoken at all actually about Dash and Violet. Do you think they're served well in the film? Do you think they have enough to do?
I think so.
Yeah, sorry.
I was just going to say that I think it was nice that focus shifted a bit more towards Violet in this one, because the first film has this center around Dash's potential, about him having to hold himself back, and then it has that beautiful moment where he's running on water and he has that little cackle and just shoots off. But with this one, I really liked that it gave us more of Violet's like inner life, let her show off her powers a little more beyond like one fight with some dude. there's that really cool bit where she like throws one of her force fields like a bolt.
Yeah.
And it's cool that she got moments like that and more time in the spotlight. Like, she got to plot and have these really inventive fights as well. Yeah. Dash is still like enjoyable, but he's just like shifted off to the side a little bit, because we know his whole deal. He's kind of his arc from the first film has more or less been resolved, so I'm happy that the film is content to just let him be.
Yeah, I feel like Violet's more of kind of a well of kind of emotion to get out of her character, because we don't really see a lot of her in the first film. She gets that really nice bit where she actually steps up to the
Tony Reidinger.
Tony Lowe.
Oh, yes. Tony Reidinger.
Yeah, she has more character arc. Dash's character arc is very kind of, well, if my parents say I can do this, then I will do it. But then, Violet's got like a bit more independence and like has her own thoughts a little bit more. But yeah, I feel like Dash was maybe sacrificed a little bit for Violet. But I don't mind. I like Violet.
I think it's a fair call. I think there's more drama to be found with teenage girls than a 10-year-old boy or whatever he is. But I would say he had no plot in this movie. He was just there to be Bart Simpson.
Yeah, he is very much Bart Simpson. I love the scene in the diner as well. That's like a great awkward dad moment.
Oh yeah,
definitely, absolutely fantastic. I nearly did a recreation.
Your eyes bulging out of your head.
Save something for the listeners.
Okay, would you like to see a third Incredibles film?
Why would you think I'd say no? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think there will be a third Incredibles film? And would you like to see one? Would you like to see one take place? Because this one also has a somewhat similar cliffhanger to the first one, where they could start things immediately again. Or would you like to see these characters older in a different environment?
I think at this point we've gotten all we can out of the characters at this stage in their lives, even if it's just like a few years, like Violet's gone to college. Even if it's just that smaller time jump, then I think I'd like that. But it all depends on whatever Brad Bird wants to do.
Mm-hmm. It'd be quite sad if we have to wait another 14 years for another one. The way that it leaves off, just makes you feel instantly like, yes, I could watch another one right now. I think I'll be fine with it if they just leave it, because I feel like it's such a kind of, they haven't messed it up yet. Don't make any more, but I could definitely go for more.
It's the benefits of being a film that's free from franchise building. it's great that it's kind of I think it'll turn a lot of people around from just being like, oh, I'm not sure about Incredibles sequels, and then just be like, more! instantly. I think it begs for a sequel without actually doing it within the context of the movie, if that makes sense.
I'd rather if Pixar just put their resources into doing new things. Personally, I'd be happy to park the Incredibles. Yeah. Not that I really did enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
But I think they're best when they're being inventive and fresh. And I've said it already. I've had enough with Pixar sequels. But I think this is the most biggest opening animation it or is. Biggest of all time. So yep. I think we are definitely going to get an Incredibles 3, aren't we?
I feel like they'll want something. But again, they can't really give it to anyone but Brad Bird. And
it, yeah, it feels let like Brad do it.
It's like
yeah.
It's something that he does. It's like Brad will do it when Brad will do it.
Yeah,
but also I can't believe you'd slander Toy Story 3 like this.
No, I don't. The Toy Stories are untouchable in my mind.
They can drop some. Yeah, they could drop some other franchises, but I think this is one that has infinitely more potential than a lot of the other films, because a lot of the other films are very purposefully intended as standalones, and then the rest of them are Cars. But so
So
I think this franchise is more suitable to sequels than others.
Yeah, they also introduce a lot. We haven't spoke about they introduced a lot of new heroes in this one as well. There's the girl whose name has escaped from my brain who can
Void.
Yeah, she was very cool. Mm. And there's the guy that spits lava. That's a weird one.
Acid reflux.
Yeah. I actually thought the owl guy was terrifying.
He was quite scary.
I didn't enjoy that at all.
He was a bit like a Watchmen character. Actually.
Yeah.
I like, for me, it was the Crusher was my favorite. Oh, yeah. Crusher, whatever.
Yeah. They don't get as much time, but it'd be nice to see more heroes.
And they're
than
very fun and colourful. There's a point in the film as well that I don't know if I've read too much into, where, because she gets given a new costume by the Deva siblings, and she says, "Oh, it's not colourful. I like things when they're really colourful and fun." And I don't know if that's a kind of comment of how superhero films are kind of have evolved. About he wants to just wants to be fun and unironic with his superheroes.
Yeah, no, it was like, what was it? She's like, "I'm not a dark character. I'm not angsty."
Yeah,
they don't even wear costumes in the Marvel thing anymore, do they? I feel like Captain America has been slowly. So next film, he'll just be wearing cargo pants and a t-shirt.
I'm trying to see where the best place in the Incredibles title to fit the letter 3 in. It could be the first E, I think.
Ooh, the E, yeah.
Incredibles.
Or they do the Roman numerals, just three eyes at the beginning.
Incredibles.
Yes. Now you're talking.
Two Incredibles. Sorry. And yeah, so we spoke a lot about this earlier. Where does this rank in the Pixar pantheon to you guys? How's it compare? Obviously, how many Pixar films are there now? Like
loads.
I don't even know. Yes.
Oh, it's not a candle on the Good Dinosaur.
I think in terms of like the new generation type ones, it's probably one of my favourites. I mean, I really, really liked Coco.
Okay.
I think it's kind of level, maybe a bit higher than that. Maybe not as good as some of the kind of early 2000s Pixar films, but I think it's definitely a really good one out of the recent ones that we've been getting.
Are you frantically counting the Pixar?
I did. Yeah, you called it. I think if my frantic finger popping here is right, 20. This is the 20th Pixar movie.
Okay.
But correct me if I'm wrong, everyone. I've got the list here in front of me.
Okay. I think it's definitely the best sequel other than Toy Stories. I really didn't get on with Finding Dory.
No, I mean,
I never saw it.
Didn't even.
Don't bother.
Yeah,
seriously, it was straight to DVD. Should have been.
It didn't work for me. Yeah. And then Monsters University is fun, but
it's okay. It's forgettable, isn't it?
Yeah, but forgettable. Yeah. So I think this is definitely the best. And you're hitting nail on the head when you said that this is the best sort of universe that allows for sequels, without it feeling cynical.
Yeah, I think it's someone that allows for the best. I mean, I don't know how they got so much mileage out of. Well, they didn't get mileage out of it. But I was going to say Cars, but
hey,
it's three.
Is no one holding out for
me
up two?
What's wrong with me today?
Up two, yeah.
Up two.
Down.
Up further. Yeah, down, yeah.
To kind of wrap up a bit here, it doubles down on the fun. I think they really go for this kind of a lot. It's a very energetic film. It's a very colourful film. I think it might be funnier. I don't think it's better than the first one. I think it might be funnier than the first one, though. I think the first one does family drama better. And it's but clearer and sort of more complex themes, whereas this one is perhaps the more successful in the comedy department than the other one.
And the action department.
And the action, absolutely.
And it looks better. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think the themes of this one didn't really land for me. I think they posit a really interesting commentary on society, the screen slavery.
Yeah.
You can figure that out.
Yeah.
As I look at my iPhone during the podcast. But I feel like it didn't really have anything to say beyond we are all slaves to our screens?
Yeah.
Like, what's the... There was no real resolution to that. I prefer Pixar when they're presenting very simple morals that a child can understand upside down.
They are kids' films.
Inside Out, it's okay to be sad. You know, it's important to be sad. It's vital to be sad. I think that's a clear... That's a clear message. I think this movie, for me anyway, is more about just let's have a fun time.
Yeah.
And it's colourful and great, which is also fine.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Know?
And I'm going to watch it again if just for the all the action scenes.
Yeah, me too. Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so that is Incredibles 2, which is out Friday the 13th of July. Ooh, not Friday the 13th. On Cars on Home Cinema, we still have the recently added Mary Shelley, and you can check out our podcast on that a few weeks ago, and our interview with Haifa Al-Mansur. And tied into Mary Shelley on Cars on Home Cinema is the Gothic Fairy Tales collection featuring Tale of Tales, La Belle et la Bête, Princess Bride, Duke of Burgundy, and some more. And if you turn your attention to the Curzon blog, you'll find our podcast co-host Amy talking with the Young Feminist Film Club about Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. It's a really great interview you can check out on the blog. Just quickly then, we did our best films of 2018 so far a few weeks ago. And we've had Stevie Reeve, who says Isle of Dogs was one of his favorite films of the year. How do we feel about this one, you know, with some time apart from it?
I only watched it once. It was pleasant. I could watch it again. Yeah. I haven't gone back to it yet because I feel like there's been a lot more out there.
I haven't seen it. I've got a baby. I only get to see it. Like, basically, you have to figure out. Yeah. You get to go to the movies a couple of times a month if we're lucky. And Isle of Dogs didn't make the cut.
Yeah, exactly. 14 years. And then Gary Ashwell is very surprised that the Best Picture winner of 2018, Shape of Water, did not get mentioned once on our Best of
show. Slam.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, I've kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
A little bit. I think it's a weird Best Picture winner.
It's a weird, yeah. Best Picture winner in a good way, but I think it's mid-tier Del Toro.
Yeah.
It tries to have things both ways with the Fishman.
She tried to have things both ways. Yeah.
But I think my main problem with that is, like, you can't have him be a nameless fishman who eats cats and then also expect us to instantly go, like, yes, I get why this one fell head over heels in love with this person.
No, but I hate cats. So for me, it was like
the ideal man.
Yeah, like, he's my hero.
Well, if you've got any thoughts on Incredibles 2, as I mentioned earlier, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show, or find us on Twitter at Curzon Cinemas. So, Cam, you have something about Peyton Reed on Twitter?
Oh, to plug. Yeah, I wrote a piece about...
This is really mysterious.
I wrote a piece about Peyton Reed's 2003? Yeah, 2003 film Down With Love, kind of retro prestige rom-com. It's based on the old Rock Hudson and Doris Day sex comedies. It's a great movie. I wrote about it in anticipation of Ant-Man, which is out in the States now, but we don't get it for another month or something. And right.
Yeah. And where can we find that?
You can find that on birthmoviesdeath.com.
Cool. Steph, anything to plug?
Not
sorry,
really.
I put you right on the spot.
I think I'm here next week to talk about Mamma Mia 2.
Oh,
so
well.
Oh, wow.
Here we go again.
Talking about Cher.
Mamma Mia.
Dave, anything to tell us about upcoming cinema episodes?
Well, if you want to hear more of me talking about The Incredibles 2, I don't know what more there is to say. Or you can hear my wife's opinion.
Yeah.
So me and Kathy did an episode which is live now. TheCinemile.com or at TheCinemile on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Go listen to it on the podcast thingies.
Perfect. So if you did enjoy the show, please subscribe, leave a review and a comment. And you can find us every Friday on iTunes and Acast. Dave, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
It was fun.
Goodbye from Cam.
Goodbye.
He's gonna dash out of here. And stretchy Steph.
Unlikely.
See ya.
See ya. Thanks. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Do-do-do-do-do.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.